Hello and welcome, friends, to this week's edition of Sustainability Now with me, Justin Mogg, here on your community radio station. We are Forward Radio, WFMP LP Louisville. We broadcast out of the top of the historic Habern Building here in downtown Louisville at 4th and Broadway. And we live stream to the world at forwardradio.org. You can pick us up anywhere you can get an internet signal and listen to our live stream, as well as archived versions of all of our local programs. You can find us there at forwardradio.org. And hey, while you're there, why don't you chip in a few bucks to help keep us on the air? This amazing community resource only costs $20 a day, so you can help sponsor an entire day's broadcast with, I'm sure, what you've got available this month to chip in to help keep us on the air at forwardradio.org. Just click donate. Or we also rely entirely on your volunteer labor. So if you want to get behind the scenes or behind the microphones here at Forward Radio, go to forwardradio.org and click participate, and maybe you could become a weekly programmer or do a one-time access hour or whatever it is you're wanting to share with the community. This is a mega phone for you, and we built it for you by you. So let's do it together here at Forward Radio. Well, what we do here on Sustainability Now is bring in folks that I'm really excited to learn more about because they're doing cool work in sustainability in our state, sometimes in our region, as we'll be talking about today, or in the nation. And I'm really excited to get Rachel Hood on the line. Rachel is an organizer with Youth for Appalachian Climate Justice. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. Let me just give you a little bit of a background about Rachel. They are a geography master's student at West Virginia University and is one of several young people who recently started Youth for Appalachian Climate Justice to address climate change across Appalachia. And that is my excuse for bringing Rachel on the air today. Rachel's also an organizer with students taking on oil and petrochemicals STOP, and recently joined the Post Landfill Action Network, known as PLAN, as a coordinator for their STOP fellowship program. And like me, Rachel graduated from Oberlin College, far more recent graduate from 2020, a fellow environmental studies alum with a concentration in environmental justice, which just wasn't a thing back in the 90s when I did this. So that's so cool that Oberlin now has an environmental justice concentration.
Yeah, they got like 20 different ones now.
Oh, really? That's so great. Well, I love it too that you are now bringing that lens to your work here in Appalachia. How did you end up in Appalachia?
Oh, wow. Well, I'm from Virginia, not Appalachian Virginia, but Virginia. And then I went to Oberlin for college. And the summer after my first year, I did an internship with Wild Virginia, which you interviewed my old boss on the show at one point.
Misty.
And so I learned more about like Appalachian Virginia. They were doing a lot with pipelines, and I got interested in pipelines, and obviously pipelines and fracking and industry are very prevalent in Appalachia.
Right.
And so I went back to Oberlin, got involved with pipelines and fracking there, and then opportunity to go to West Virginia University for my master's to continue research on pipelines. And recently moved to Pittsburgh, and so I've done like four of the states.
Yeah,
maybe Kentucky will be the next one.
That's right. Just keep on sliding down the Ohio River Valley, and we'll gladly have you. So, I mean, this program and other programs here on our station have covered this before. But I'm sure there are many of our listeners who just aren't that familiar here in Louisville anyway, with the petrochemical buildout that's been happening in our Ohio River Valley. Why is this such a pressing issue for the Ohio River Valley?
Yeah, I think the easiest way to understand why people are so concerned about it is to look at Cancer Alley or Death Alley in the Gulf Coast, which is a current petrochemical corridor. They have like over 150 chemical plants and plastics facilities and petrochemical facilities, and the cancer rates there are double the national average. And it's like a really horrible instance of environmental injustice, so much so that the UN has called out the environmental racism of that area. And so Appalachia is targeted as the next corridor. Appalachia sits on very large shale gas basins. And so it's it's very easy to frack in the same place that you pipeline the gas, in the same place that you process the gas on the Ohio River. And so for all sorts of reasons, including economic, including social, including environmental, it's just all around a horrible idea, and it would be a very scary development for the region.
Yeah. And it's funny because folks here in Kentucky have, many folks have been long struggling against us being a coal state, right? And you even still see that fight going on today, even though there's like so few coal jobs left in our state, but you still see, you know, the battle between the license plates, right? The Friends of Coal license plates in our state versus the Friends of Soul bumper stickers, right? We've been struggling against coal for so long. It's easy to get your blinders on and forget that that's just not the only fossil fuel industry we have to be worried about here in Kentucky, right?
Yeah. And I think, you know, coal is still happening in West Virginia, certainly. I mean, again, yeah, the jobs are very few, but people are like, oh, that's still going on. It's yeah. It's still happening. But, you know, West Virginia, Ohio, Pennsylvania sit on the Marcellus Shale. So now with coal declining, oil and natural gas came in. It was very opportunistic because one declines, the other rises.
Yeah. And I mean, in some ways, it's a slight improvement environmentally, burning it. Coal and power plants is like definitely the quickest way to jump off the climate change cliff. But, you know, burning natural gas is cleaner in some ways, but it's certainly not a sustainable source. And we're interviewing today on October 4th. And, you know, I was just hearing on the BBC News how there's a global shortage now of natural gas already. I think a lot of these power plants are switching over. And so we're going to see, I think, the pressures on fracking to increase, right?
Well, it's sort of complicated. And I also think maybe we're zooming in on the burning, natural gas is cleaner, but in so many other ways, it's still a very dirty fuel. And even if you just look at like methane leaks from fracking and pipelines, like those are a huge source of emissions that aren't even accounted for in like the burning of the fuel. But as far as Appalachia goes, fracking largely at this point doesn't go toward energy. It's going toward this plastics build out, which is what the petrochemical build out ultimately leads to, because these petrochemical plants, these cracker plants, make what are called nurdles, which are plastic pellets. And so there was this like overproduction in fracking and natural gas, and oil prices fell so low. I think we all remember in COVID when oil was negative.
Yeah. You couldn't give it away.
So they've overfracked and they've like are hundreds of billions of dollars in debt. And so now they're looking at this plastics build out as the bailout for the fracking industry. And so they're creating a supply for a demand that isn't there. I think one environmental thing that most people agree on is that we need to get away from plastic, but they see an opportunity of if they make it, it will get used.
Yeah, it's so cheap and abundant as a sort of byproduct of the chemical and or the fossil fuel industry that we don't even think of recycling it anymore, right? We used to just ship it off to China, and then China said, no, we're not going to take your plastic anymore, America. So I think there's a common myth amongst consumers that, well, it's okay. We'll just recycle this plastic. I can use as much as I want, and it can get recycled into something new. What's the truth behind that?
Well, the truth is that only 9% of plastics ever made have been recycled.
Wow.
Yeah. And I would encourage everyone, The Story of Plastics is a documentary that just won an Emmy. Congratulations. And you can watch it for free on YouTube, I think through November 30th. And it's an awesome documentary that like from cradle to grave explains every part of the plastic pollution cycle. But yeah, the reality is that we used to ship a lot of plastics to China. They started rejecting all plastic imports. I think it's the National Sword Act, I think was the name of it.
Yeah, something like that.
We've started shipping them to other countries and a lot in Southeast Asia, which do not have the capacity to take on hundreds of millions of tons of plastic. And so these countries are flooded with plastic, not only from the United States, but Canada and European countries. and they're just like drowning in plastic. And people will talk about the crisis of plastic pollution in the oceans, and they'll say, well, it's coming from these five countries. But the reality is that those countries have that plastic because the United States and Europe and Canada are shipping it to them. Mm. And yeah, so much of plastic is not made to be recycled. Mm.
So tell me about being a Students Taking On Oil and Petrochemicals organizer. What does that mean?
Yeah. So it's six students in the Ohio River Valley at six different schools. I was in the first cohort last year, and now I'm the coordinator for their program. But really, it was started because of this targeted petrochemical build out. And so it was a way to resource and support students doing that work on their campuses. Mm. And so we had students in West Virginia, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Kentucky.
Oh, yeah.
A student who's doing awesome work. They got rid of plastic water at the campus. They've got it.
Which campus?
At University of Louisville. They're negotiating the contract to get just, I think, canned water. Yeah.
Oh, right. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Shout out Bryant.
Yeah, Bryant.
So part of it is supporting the students to do the work on their campus, and part of it is connecting students in Appalachia doing that work, because there's not a lot of representation when it comes to youth in Appalachia as far as the youth voice. Certainly there are awesome organizations, the Stay Project being one of them, but it's hard for Appalachian students to connect, in part because, you know, national organizations don't really resource Appalachian areas. Like, you know, the Sunrise Movement doesn't have really funding for rural organizing.
Yeah.
And so for those reasons, it was exciting to be able to connect students and say, and to help build relationships with organizers in the region who are fighting the same things, and to empower students to work together.
Yeah, that's great. And of course, now you're making a connection too with PLAN, the Post Landfill Action Network. You want to talk a little bit about that and who PLAN is?
Yeah. So PLAN, I believe, just had their eighth birthday.
Oh, yeah.
They are a nonprofit. They were started by college students who worked to start a move-out program on their campus. So instead of everything going to the trash when students move out, they're collecting it and either selling it or having like a free store, a giant free store. And so now PLAN works to support students across the country who are working towards zero-waste campuses. So they'll support students working on compost programs or free stores or food rescue or move out programs, all sorts of things. And so I learned about them when I was at Oberlin, when I worked for the resource conservation team at Oberlin, who did a lot of that work, and stayed connected with them throughout my time at Oberlin. And towards the end of, it was actually in like May 2020, I connected with Young, who is the campaign coordinator for Breakthrough from Plastics, about this petrochemical build out. And so going into WVU, I became one of the staff students.
Yeah. Well, I got to shout out Post Landfill Action Network too. They've been very helpful at the University of Louisville. We've hosted fellows through them to do an audit, basically an assessment of where we're at. That's a sort of benchmarking where we're at in terms of solid waste, and then they helped us through a zero waste visioning process, and so that has been just a delight to have external facilitators, you know, sort of in from the student-led movement, but also know what's going on at other campuses to help us see a way forward and not get stuck on our own internal issues. That's been great. So now you're working as a STOP organizer along with PLAN. How does that look?
Yeah, so last year we didn't have necessarily like a STOP coordinator. Young was doing that work in addition to doing a lot of other work.
And yeah. So
this year, they decided that they wanted to have someone who is dedicated to the program, because it is like one of the more involved things that PLAN has. It's pretty unique. There's not necessarily programs for other areas like that. And so, you know, most of what I do is just mentoring the new students and like supporting them, bringing educational resources. So like we're doing a lot of leadership training in the fall. And then in the later fall and into the spring, they'll be working on their like campus projects, targeting some aspect of plastics and petrochemicals on their campus. And it's really awesome just to be able to like work with other, you know, I'm not that much older than them.
Right.
But it's really awesome to like work with other young people who have like a lot of energy and are passionate about this, and to be able to like learn from them and to see them grow as organizers. And so really most of the day to day is just like supporting them and helping them figure out projects, bringing in like speakers or workshops. And then I do some other stuff with like the People of Perpetua Coalition and then Youth for Appalachian Climate Justice. Those sort of intertwine with the STOP work, because part of what I'm trying to do is help them build relationships in the region beyond STOP.
That's great. I'm speaking today with Rachel Hood. They are an organizer with Youth for Appalachian Climate Justice, as you just heard about. And they're a geography master's student at West Virginia University and one of several young people who recently started this group. And you mentioned the story of plastic. I just wanted to point out, we'll put a link to that on the show notes for the podcast version of this, which you can find at forwardradio.org. But tell us more about this process of organizing Youth for Appalachian Climate Justice and how the group works.
Yeah, so that was born out of the STOP cohort. In the spring, we wanted to, you know, there are Appalachian students from across the region, and we were talking about how a lot of Appalachian youth leave, and there's the STAY project does a lot of important work around that. And we wanted to be able to create another space that was focused, you know, around climate justice and around these, you know, sort of thought of as environmental issues, but I would argue that they're not just environmental issues.
Right.
They're, you know, comprehensive issues. but we wanted to create a space where youth could in Appalachia could connect with other people who are doing that work, and also that they had an autonomous space where they could drive the conversations and decide what they wanted to do. Because we found that in a lot of these mainstream environmental spaces, people really want to see youth show up, but youth don't get to see the agenda, and they don't necessarily get to decide on initiatives or on values as an organization. And it becomes a lot of patronizing in a way of like, oh, we're so excited that you're here. But also when you say things that are more radical, or when you say things that, you know, challenge us, that we don't actually, you know, want to see that. We just want you to be a young person so we can feel like we have young people, you know?
Yeah, that must be a huge problem.
Yeah, it's very frustrating. And so we wanted to have just an autonomous space where like we weren't inhibited by sort of other people like policing our language or deciding what environmentalism should be. And we started with planning this conference in the summer, which was wild because it was our first time planning a conference, and it was in COVID and it was virtual. So it was definitely a learning experience, but I think it was still really great. We got to bring in a bunch of awesome speakers from Appalachia. Young people doing a variety of different things and meeting new people. And so now from that, we're, you know, figuring out what exactly this space should be. So, you know, whether it's monthly meetings or whether it's specific projects, I think it's still, we're not necessarily trying to force it to be a certain thing. We're sort of letting it be what people want it to be at that moment. So maybe it'll be a yearly conference. Maybe it'll be monthly meetings or an organization that sends representatives to other people. I mean, ultimately that's kind of like the beauty of it though, is that like, we're just figuring it out together, and like we're learning and we're not inhibited by like pre-existing structures and having to operate within those.
Can we talk more? Can we dive more into this issue of mainstream environmental groups versus these youth movements? I mean, for those of us who aren't youth, we might not know what perspective you're coming from. So obviously there's a like not being heard perspective, not being given leadership roles. I totally get that. But what were some of the issues that you noticed youth clashing with in contrast to where the mainstream environmental groups were?
Mm-hmm. I think at a very like basic level, it has to do with like what we define environmentalism as. So like, you know, summer of 2020, like with the uprisings, obviously there were so many different like connections that were being made and like thinking more systemically. And so like there were articles talking about how abolish the police is climate policy, and how the U.S. military is a huge contributor to emissions. And so in some of these spaces, you could not even bring that up. It was like, that's not what we're here to do. We are here because we are all threatened by climate change. Like, it's the universal threat, which we know it not to be, because there is no such thing as a universal threat when we're existing in systems of capitalism and imperialism, when certain people have mobility and others don't. Right.
Sort of all lives matter approach is what you're encountering. It sounds
but I think that's a great example of we should be talking about those things and bringing that analysis to what we're doing as an organization. And the fact that you can't even bring that up and you're shut down and told you're being distracting, or that you're making this political when climate change shouldn't be political, which is the most ridiculous thing. There's no such thing as something that isn't political. It's a worldwide change,
Yeah.
And I think also just there's so many other ways in which young people want to expand not only what environmentalism means, but what environmental or climate justice work is. So, a mutual aid fund is climate justice, because people are being threatened by hurricanes and by earthquakes and wildfires and all these things. And how are you going to care for people when we're seeing climate change's effects today? And I think also just it's such a stereotype that young people are more radical, but it's true. And I reject the claim that that's going to go away as we get older. I think that I don't see that with, our generation. I don't see how that's going to be possible when we're, confronting the climate crisis. I don't see how anyone's going to de-radicalize.
Well, I think the sense of urgency is just very different amongst youth, which is, again, a stereotype. It's often true. But when we're talking about climate change, I mean, this stuff's getting real.
All these folks will be like, I just feel so sorry for your generation. One of the most infuriating things. It's like, well, first of all, climate change is happening now. We could die in a hurricane. So your generation is affected. But second of all, if you feel sorry for us, why are you standing in the way of us leading this? Or standing in the way of the work that we think needs to happen if we're the ones that are going to suffer the consequences. Yeah. And it is a sense of urgency. And I think it's a sense that we exist in a world in which that is the reality. It's not a possibility. It's not far away. It's happening right now. And we're very aware of it, because it's only going to, barring some godlike intervention, it's only gonna accelerate. And I think we just don't have the time to shake hands and feel good and be let's congratulate ourselves here. We have lives to save, man.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's a new consciousness too that I think is emerging in all generations. But youth are essentially native to this consciousness of the connections between racism and colonialism and capitalism and our environmental crises. When the sort of environmental movements kicked off, I don't know that necessarily everybody in the movement was thinking, we've got to get rid of racism and colonialism and capitalism if we want to achieve these goals. But I think the longer environmentalists have failed to make progress, the more we understand that these are the root causes of the planetary injustice we see as a people injustice too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't talk about climate change without talking about those things. We got to this place first through a long legacy of colonialism and enslavement that created the economic systems that we exist in, through imperialism, resource colonies, extraction, you know, all of these legacies that have led us to where we are today, we would not have climate change without capitalism, because capitalism encourages such ridiculous consumption and such ridiculous inequities in wealth. And like, you know, 100 corporations are responsible for 70% of emissions. Like, how can you talk about climate change if you're not talking about corporations and capitalism? You know, we can't like plant trees our way out of this. And ultimately, if your solutions don't address those things, that they're not solutions. They might be solutions for you and for the problem that's affecting your life, but it's not a solution. Like, people will talk about, oh, like, we need to go all solar. And, you know, like, I get where that's coming from, but like, solar requires lithium. Like, 90% of lithium's in Chile. Like, you have to remove people from their lands, colonize the area, extract, create like horrible environmental conditions. And it's just the same cycle over and over. And it, you know, that's not a problem for you anymore, but it's still a problem. Like, people, you know, if we're suffering in Appalachia because of extraction, how can we then say, well, the solution is just to put that on someone else?
Right.
You know, it's just, it's a cycle.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of a global level NIMBYism, not in my backyard.
Yeah,
but it's exactly. Okay if it's even outside our borders.
Exactly.
And why are there all these refugees at our borders now, you know? And it's only going to be accelerated with global climate change and people losing their homes and their livelihoods in the places they are because of climate extremes and sea level rise. And so we better get a lot better at welcoming refugees. Which is sad but true, right? And Appalachia could actually be a place to do just that work. We have land, we have resources, we have the ability to accept. We need workers. This is actually a great place for resettlement, but that's a topic for a different show. I'm speaking today with Rachel Hood. They're an organizer with Youth for Appalachian Climate Justice, current grad student at West Virginia University, an alum of my alma mater as well, Oberlin College, with a BA in Environmental Studies and a concentration in Environmental Justice. Can we talk a little bit about what you did at Oberlin? I mean, you mentioned the resource conservation team and organizing with students against fracking and pipelines in Northeast Ohio. I can imagine what that looks like, given my experience organizing at Oberlin too. But what I really would love to hear more about is your field work, getting your undergraduate degree, documenting farmers' experiences of climate change in Zanzibar. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So I did a study abroad program in Zanzibar my junior year, and we did you know, like a mini thesis.
Wow.
And so I was talking, wow, you're asking me about something I did 3 years ago.
That I know. It's a lifetime.
I hope that I'm being accurate to my former self here. I was looking at farmer perceptions of climate change, because there's a lot of policies made at, you know, the zoomed out level.
Yeah.
That don't involve necessarily talking to farmers,
yep,
about what they're experiencing. And there's, I think also in some of these like plans and literature and things, there's not necessarily like a recognition of what farmers are already doing and what farmers already know to be true. And so it was really just documenting the very like specific consequences of climate change for farmers.
Yeah. What does it look like in Zanzibar? Is sea level rise a big issue, or what are some of the impacts?
There's a lot having to do with like pests and fungus.
Yeah.
Killing crops. There's a lot having to do with just water supply. So
yeah,
Zanzibar has two rainy seasons and the rain is much more irregular. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you go dry spells and then you have flooding, and then there's dry mm-hmm. spells. Flooding. It's not the regular, you know, consistent water supply that's not too much water. So that's something has been issues with the rainy season and with the dry season. And I think, you know, just all of the things that you would expect with climate change, as far as heat, as far as precipitation, as far as pest invasions, and, you know, all of these consequences of climate change. And I think that, you know, those things have been documented in all sorts of places, but it was just a way to document it in this very specific, you know, very small area where very little research is done. It was, you know, in Zanzibar is actually an archipelago, and so I was on the island of Pemba.
There you go.
Four islands. So it's a very small area, and trying to, like, do something that would be helpful in terms of, like, you know, gathering data about what this looks like and what people are doing and what could happen.
Yeah. Well, I did my graduate work interviewing farmers in the southern Philippines. So I feel a lot of similarities to the experience that you had. And certainly climate change wasn't the focus of the work, but sustainable development sure was. And figuring out what that means for farmers was what my study was all about. Like I first of all, I had to figure out what the literature said, you know, sustainable development meant. And then I had to go to a place like the Southern Philippines and figure out what it meant there, and then use that sort of 30,000 feet knowledge to help inform my understanding of the process locally. It's a classic problem of international development, is that we don't really understand at a deep level those local issues. And so we come in with money or a project and try to impose, a solution that we think is going to work because it worked elsewhere, or it makes sense on paper, right? And in a sense, that's neocolonialism.
Oh, absolutely. I could do a whole separate podcast about academia and colonialism, trust me.
Yeah.
But I think all the students there were very aware that, like, very little research is done in that area because it's, you know, it's very small and doesn't get, like, a lot of resources. And so, like, the student research actually had potential to, like, contribute something important. I mean, like, students through that program have done, like, longitudinal studies of different species and things like that. And so I was trying to, you know, do something that could be a tool for farmers in Zanzibar, and for the farmer agencies in Zanzibar to, you know, get a snapshot of what people are doing and, you know, what are the things that a lot of farmers are struggling with. And the farming agency, Pemba, is, like, already doing a lot of that. And, you know, they're doing really important stuff. And so I think it's just, like, trying to contribute something,
right,
some sort of documentation that maybe would be helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and now you're working on your master's thesis, and it's about the pipeline build out in the Ohio River Valley. You want to talk a little bit more about that? Is this sort of participant observation research, or what exactly are you doing?
Yeah. So essentially I'm trying to understand what it's like to live with pipelines. So I'm talking to essentially, like, homeowners who have pipelines on or near their property. And it's really just getting a sense of, like, how does this impact you physically and emotionally and mentally? I think, you know, energy research is dominated by technical disciplines. So they're looking at, like, the mechanics of making the energy, the economics of the energy, the geology of the build out. But there's, you know, very little research about the social consequences. And, you know, there's the physical environmental consequences, but what about the social environmental consequences? Yeah. And so I've just been, you know, interviewing folks about what it's like for them to live near that. And it's related to research that my advisor has about this issue in West Virginia, but I'm expanding it to be more in Ohio and Pennsylvania, which are obviously also part of this Ohio River Valley that's a target. And I think it's really important just to give people the space to talk about it and have someone listen to them, because most people ignore them and silence them and invalidate their realities. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important to intervene in this, like, technical dominance and this literature being like, oh, you know, statistically speaking, this is how safe pipelines are. Yeah. This is how, like, and it's like, well, those statistics don't tell you who's living next to a bomb.
Yeah. Right. So if you could, we're nearing the end, but I'd love it if you could sort of take our listeners to some of these communities that are being impacted by the petrochemical build out and help us understand those perspectives you're learning about. You don't have to make this about one specific person, but could you introduce us to a family that's impacted by this? What does the life look like for them? What are they concerned about?
Yeah. Well, I don't want to get too specific with locations.
Right.
But there are these things called compressor stations, which you need every however many miles on a pipeline to recompress and repressurize the gas so that it keeps going down the pipeline. And in addition to that, they're often burning off a lot of the volatile organic compounds and other sorts of nasty that's in the natural gas. And so if you're living next to a compressor station, you are constantly inundated with toxic fumes.
Wow.
So not only are you living with a pipeline that could potentially explode, but then you are, you know, tasting like metal in your mouth.
Yeah.
You go outside and you're gagging because of how bad it smells. And I talked to these people who got COVID in like April of 2020, and the compressor station was still going, and they're trying, like, their lungs are already, they're trying to breathe in their house, and they have to like have washcloths over their face because there's so much gunk in the air and it smells so bad and it's literally burning their lungs.
Wow.
Like, that's, but you know, according to these technical disciplines, like, that's, you know, it's so, these impacts are so low. It's like, how are you going to look at someone who can't breathe in their own house and say, well, this is actually a really minimal effect?
Yeah. So these are regulated to some level, and maybe they're meeting the standards, but people are impacted. Is that what you're saying? Or they're not even regulated?
Oh, God. Well, what I will say first as fact, and not as opinion, as fact, is that, you know, the EPA and these regulatory agencies were created to allow businesses to operate while meeting certain standards. So if a compressor is inspected and is meeting a standard, that does not mean that that is a just standard.
Yeah.
You know, there was this other couple who lives next to this, I forget what it's called. It's some station having to do with the pipeline that's right outside their house. And it's like roaring. It's so loud.
Wow.
The standard is 55 decibels. And they had someone come out and, you know, do a sound study. And they came back and said, well, this is 53.6 decibels.
So
and they're like, I enjoy don't care it. If you're compliant. Like, you're barely compliant. Like, I, like, can't go outside because it's so loud. So regardless of whether people are meeting standards, like, it doesn't really matter when it comes to what your life looks like.
Yeah.
And, like, all they get back is, well, we're compliant, so live with it.
Yeah.
Like, that's not just. And if that were you, you wouldn't care if they were compliant.
Yeah, we face the same issues here in Louisville. They, of course, tend to be concentrated in the west end of our city, where black and brown people are overrepresented and other marginalized communities. And yeah, that's the kind of answer you'll get from the Air Pollution Control District. I don't know about noise pollution. Maybe that's an issue too. But I've been in so many public meetings where I've heard the regulators basically say that same thing. Like, well, we know this stuff isn't good, but they're meeting the rules, so we can't really do anything about it. Well, you know, that's not a satisfactory answer for our communities, is it?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it just comes down to, like, if you were that person, if that regulator tried to go live in that house, like, would they be like, well, it's compliant, so like,
walk a mile in these shoes? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, nobody wants to live in a place where they can't go outside their house. And the reality is that those regulations allow for that.
Yeah. Well, we're nearing the end of our time, so I just wonder if we could wrap up with maybe on a slightly positive note, because this is pretty depressing stuff, right? Like, I understand the need to organize against things that threaten our communities and our most marginalized members of our communities especially, but it's also important to organize with a vision in mind. So I wonder if, Rachel, if you could end by sort of sharing what your vision for a more just Appalachia future would be.
Well, it's a 36-point plan. No. I mean, I think, you know, at sort of a basic level, it's in Appalachia where people have jobs that are dignifying. You know, people have jobs that meet their needs and that aren't harming them. It's in Appalachia where people can trust their water, can trust their air, can trust their food. It's in Appalachia where people don't internalize the narratives of Appalachia that other people in Appalachia. It's in Appalachia where people are proud to be there. And I think lots of people are, but I think it's a matter of, you know, being loud and proud to the rest of the world about it. And, you know, Appalachia has so much beauty and so much history and depth to it. And I think creating the conditions where people don't have to live in fear of what's, you know, what's in their water or what's on the land, and can, you know, build really beautiful community, and transform it into just, you know, a world where you don't have to choose between your health or your livelihood. You don't have to choose between your family and your job. You don't have to make these choices. These choices shouldn't exist. So it's an Appalachia just where there's dignity and love and care.
Well, Appalachia deserves it all. We want it all. So I really honor you, Rachel, for doing this work. I thank you so much for doing it and for taking the time to speak with us about it today. Is there a place online people can go to learn more and get involved?
I will direct them to the Youth for Appalachian Climate Justice social media, which is @youthforacj. Post Landfill Action Network, also a social media. You can find them @postlandfill. I don't really do social media, so.
No, that's good. That's good. All right. I'll put those links in the show notes, which you can find at forwardradio.org. And keep up the good fight, my friend. This is fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was an honor to be here.
Wonderful. All right. Stay tuned, everybody. Coming up in just a second, your community action calendar. Yes, I've got all kinds of ideas about how you can get engaged in sustainability this week. So stay tuned, my friends.
When I was a child, I walked these hills, drank from the streams and heard the whippoorwills, and I ran through the fields just as fast as I could, through rocks in the creek, up the deep green woods, climbed up on the mountain, there as fresh as could be. Let my Kentucky soul fly free, fly free, fly free. Down from the Ohio to the Big Sandy, and up in the mountain holler, down to the big city. Gonna let my Kentucky soul fly free. Now that I'm a man, I live in the big city. It's a crazy life, don't bother me. It's deep down inside, I'm still a country boy. You know I gotta get back to where I was born. Down by the rivers, where I long to be. My Kentucky soul fly free, fly free, fly free, down from the Ohio to the Big Sandy.
And we're back here on Sustainability Now with me, Justin Mogg, listening to the sweet sounds of Appalachian. Many thanks to them for giving us permission to use their local music here on our podcast versions of our programs, which you can find at forwardradio.org, and you can learn more about them at appalachian.com. Well, friends, this is your week. This is time to take action for sustainability. It's not going to happen without you. Sustainability doesn't happen alone. It happens when we get together to learn and make a difference. And there is so much to do this week. So get your calendars out and your pencils sharpened, and let's get ready to get action active for sustainability. I mentioned it last week. The community tree plantings with the Metro Division of Community Forestry continue this week. Louisville Parks and Recreation is seeking volunteers like you to help with fall planting of street trees right here in our urban core. No experience is necessary. Tools, gloves, and instruction are all provided. This year, they're focusing on the downtown Central Business District right here where Forward Radio is coming to you from, because it is one of the worst heat islands in Louisville. So few trees, so little tree canopy left. Let's work together to restore it this week. You can join Tuesday the 19th from 5:30 to 7:30 after work, or Wednesday morning on the 20th from 10 a.m. to noon. Thursday the 21st, 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. And this Friday, October 22nd from 10 a.m. to noon. And it continues through November 7th. You'll need to register for these volunteer opportunities in order to be sent the specific downtown location where the planting will happen. And you can do so by using the Better Impact app. And you can find the link to register at facebook.com/LouUrbanForestry, L-O-U Urban Forestry. And for any questions, you can contact Sarah, S-A-R-A-H dot Flarsheim, F-L-A-R-S-H-E-I-M at louisvilleky.gov, or give her a call or text at 502-901-8191. And I hope to see you out on the streets of downtown Louisville planting trees with me this week and next. Now, also coming up on Tuesday, October 19th in the evening, starting at 5 p.m., Louisville Community Grocery and the Louisville Association for Community Economics are having their annual membership meeting at 1619 Flux. They are 1619 West Main Street. You can meet the Lace and Louisville Community Grocery community at the annual membership and owners meeting on Tuesday. The meetings start at 5 p.m. and then dinner will be provided by Garden Girl Foods from Old Louisville, and music with KMF will begin immediately afterward. You can RSVP for the dinner at louisvillecommunitygrocery.com/blog. And if you have any questions, just send them to ownership@louisvillecommunitygrocery.com. Other things to note, you can join them in saying hello to their new employees. Yes, they have an ownership manager, an administrative associate, and an interim executive director. They're eager to collaborate, bringing renewed energy and a fresh perspective on making the goals of Louisville Community Grocery a reality. And they are hiring more members of the mighty team. In partnership with Common Table and Catholic Charities, they're ready to launch the Louisville Community Grocery Deli Up service. And it's a delivery service, and they need creative, collaborative project manager to lead to success. And they're looking for an energetic, savvy volunteer coordinator to connect the fabulous volunteers with opportunities to advance the mission and strengthen our community. You can learn more about all of it at louisvillecommunitygrocery.com/opportunities. And we hope to see you if you're a member, or join now. This is a great excuse to join the Louisville Community Grocery. Become a part owner today in this important effort at food justice and the food apartheid zones of our downtown. Coming up on Tuesday, October 19th at 7 p.m. as well via Zoom, the Greater Louisville Sierra Club is having their monthly program. It'll be online with Sarah Carballo from the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition. And Sarah will talk about OVEC's efforts in southeastern Ohio, West Virginia, and eastern Kentucky, and how we can support their good work. The Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition formed in 1987 to stop a toxic waste facility proposed for a low-income community near Huntington. Though the organization has fought many different kinds of campaigns over the years, the current focus of their work is stopping the proliferation of the petrochemical build-out along the Ohio River and its tributaries. To achieve that mission, they are organizing in communities from eastern Kentucky to the farthest reaches of West Virginia's northern panhandle to help inform residents and inspire them to take action to protect the environment and their communities. You can find the link to register for the Tuesday evening program at sierraclub.org/Kentucky. Again, it's Tuesday, 7 p.m. via Zoom. Go to sierraclub.org/Kentucky. Now, coming up on Friday, the 22nd, at 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. out at Bernheim, there's going to be a native plant sale. You're invited out to Bernheim for the return of their fall plant sale. Over the past several years, their horticulture team has grown a variety of native trees and shrubs from saplings. They have now grown into fine specimens that are ready to leave the hoop house to find a home outside of Bernheim. So come and explore the beauty and functionality that natives can provide for your landscape. Learn more at bernheim.org. And again, the plant sale is this Friday the 22nd from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. out at Bernheim, just south of Louisville. Now, continuing on Saturday, it's the Tenant Organizing Training, Collectivizing Our Struggles, taking place at various locations in person around Kentucky and for everyone online. And again, it's in collaboration with tenant-led organizations across the state, led by Kentucky Tenants, a project of Root Cause Research Center. And this October and November and into December, the trainings continue every Saturday from 2 to 3:30 p.m. This October 23rd, they'll be meeting with the topic will be meeting with decision makers, and it goes through December 18th, where it will wrap up in person here in Louisville on tenant organizing in Kentucky. Where do we go from here? You can sign up anytime between now and the final training on the 18th of December. Learn more and register to participate at rootcauseresearch.org/tenant training. Saturday the 23rd is also the next Louisville Grows tree planting. I've been waiting since spring to get back with my good friends at Louisville Grows to plant trees together in our community. And this Saturday from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., we will be planting trees in South Louisville again. We'll be meeting up at Wyandotte Park there at 1104 Beecher Street. But you will need to register in advance at tinyurl.com/GHOCT2021. Calling all volunteers as we dig into this season of tree plantings starting on Saturday the 23rd. Help us increase the tree canopy in the neighborhoods most impacted by the urban heat island effect. This planting will focus on the Taylorberry, Jacobs, Hazelwood, Beachmont, Oakdale, and Wilder Park neighborhoods of South Louisville. This October tree planting is in partnership with U of L's Green Heart Project, a first-of-its-kind multi-year study. By taking a closer look at the relationship we have with our neighborhood trees and their effects on our mental and physical health, we can continue to grow greener, healthier neighborhoods. If you would like to learn more, visit greenheartlouisville.com. And please contact Charlie at volunteer@louisvillegrows.org with any questions or concerns. But again, you can find the link to register for this Greenheart tree planting at louisville.edu/sustainability. Also on Saturday the 23rd at 8:30 a.m. to noon, it is Central Park Improvement Day. They do it every spring and fall. The Old Louisville Neighborhood Council and U of L's Sustainability Council invites everybody out to volunteer. If you don't want to plant trees in South Louisville, come on out to Central Park for their great improvement days. Consider volunteering a few hours of your time to do light chores to spruce up this historic Olmsted Park near in the heart of Old Louisville. Meet at the Visitors Center at 8:30 a.m. for coffee, hot chocolate, and donuts at the check-in. Councilman David James will be providing a free pizza and chili lunch at noon for everyone who volunteers. And it is just co-sponsored by the councilman, as well as Brightside, Metro Parks, and Olmsted Parks Conservancy. You can learn more at louisville.edu/sustainability, but you don't need to register in advance. Just show up this Saturday, 8:30 a.m. to noon at Central Park, and there's plenty to do. Also, Saturday the 23rd, yes, have you heard the theme? There is a lot going on this Saturday. If you're not doing something for sustainability on Saturday, you're not doing anything right. Man, Louisville Earth Walk is happening this Saturday the 23rd as well, from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. at Cherokee Park's Hogan Fountain. And Forward Radio is proud to be a co-sponsor of this great event. All are invited to join in the Louisville Earth Walk. It's a non-competitive community event featuring a walk and virtual participation participation options. The walk is in Cherokee Park for this fifth year of the walk on Saturday the 23rd, and registration's open. There are two free registration options, in person at the park starting at 9 a.m., and a virtual option that allows you to participate from wherever you are. Registration and donation links are available at LouisvilleEarthWalk.org. Join us as we celebrate Planet Earth and the organizations that work on her behalf. Proceeds will be distributed among 12 different environmental nonprofit organizing partners, including the amazing Project Warm, Passionist Earth and Spirit Center, Our Earth Now, Louisville Sustainability Council, Louisville Grows, Louisville Climate Action Network, Kentucky Interfaith Power and Light, Kentucky Conservation Committee, Kentuckians for the Commonwealth, Greater Louisville Sierra Club, Food Literacy Project, and Cultivating Connections. Again, details and registration are at LouisvilleEarthWalk.org. Also, Saturday, October 23rd is a Brightside community-wide cleanup. Be part of this citywide event to help keep Louisville looking bright and beautiful by signing up online. Brightside encourages all residents to make a difference by taking part. It's a great opportunity to serve your community, especially for things like Boy or Girl Scouts, a sports team, faith group, community organizations, corporate teams, and individuals. Cleanups are an integral part of Brightside's mission, and without the help of you, the volunteers, and many throughout the year, Brightside could not achieve the goal of a cleaner, greener Louisville. Get more information at facebook.com/BrightsideLouisville, or you can sign up at LouisvilleKY.gov. Hey, also this October 23rd, it's the next in the Metro Louisville's pop-up drop-off events from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. It's free recycling of all kinds of items, and it's going to be out at Metro Fleet Services this time on Saturday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. That's 3515 Newburg Road. You can bring up to 3 electronics per household, metal and appliances, your household recyclables, prescription medications for proper disposal, yard waste. There'll be free on-site paper shredding and recycling. You can drop up to 4 passenger tires for recycling. It's going to be great. So come on out this Saturday the 23rd, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Metro Fleet Services, 3515 Newburg Road. And lastly, U of L Sustainability Week kicks off this week. It's a full week of events to celebrate, raise awareness, and engage your passions for environmental, social, and economic justice. Everyone is welcome, and it starts this Sunday the 24th with our Community Composting Voluntary Day from noon to 2 p.m. every Sunday, and it's at the 200 block of East Bloom Street. That's just one block north of Cardinal Boulevard between Brook and Floyd Streets. Come on out, dress to get dirty. Then on Monday, October 25th at 5 p.m., there'll be a workday at the Urban and Public Affairs Garden and Greenhouse located at 426 West Bloom Street. So come on out for that. And continues on Tuesday, October 26th from 11:30 to 1:30. There'll be a free store. The U of L free store will be having its outdoor free sale at the clock tower at 11:30 to 1:30 on Tuesday the 26th. And there is more information available at louisville.edu/sustainability. All right, my friends, that's all the time we have for today for Sustainability Now. Thanks so much for tuning in. And I look forward to being back in your ears again in 1 week's time, my friends. Be well.
By and by, hard times are coming knocking at the door. My whole Kentucky home, good night.